Many Americans had the sense, even on the day they happened, that the 9/11 attacks would change everything. But it's fair to say very few of us understood how we would change. For a brief moment, we came together in our shock and grief and felt the sympathy from people all over the world, including most of the Muslim world. But our fear and anger led leaders to embrace policies that would have been unthinkable to most of us literally the day before the attacks, and ultimately fed a toxic distrust of the very government we had once trusted to protect us. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. The new documentary by journalist Michael Kirk for the PBS series Frontline is called America After 9/11. It explores the consequences of our loss of faith in leaders as one president after another made promises he couldn't keep, and conspiracy theorists seized on our anxiety and disorientation to deepen the divides between ordinary citizens. Michael, welcome back to Think.
It's great to be here, Chris. Thank you.
For a very short time after the attacks, it seemed like we would be unified across partisan divides. Of course, that didn't last, and it reminds us, the film reminds us of all the ways our leaders failed us. I want to listen to President Bush on the night of 9/11.
Now we go to the Oval Office and President Bush.
America was targeted for attack because we're the brightest beacon for freedom and opportunity in the world, and no one will keep that light from shining. Today, our nation saw evil, the very worst of human nature.
Michael, how did the Bush administration define what we were up against in the immediate aftermath of the attacks?
I think they were so surprised by the attack. And I think New President Bush, he was 9 months into his term, decided to put it in the starkest terms. We were the good guys. They were the evildoers. And as the good guys, it was our job to rid the world of evildoers. He made it as black and white, as binary as possible.
Of course, you set up that binary. And if we've decided we're the good guys, then it implies, accurately or not, that anything we might do will be good and moral.
Yes, it doesn't leave you, as one of the people in our film says tonight, it doesn't leave you a lot of room to do the kind of tough stuff you have to do, perhaps, if you're in a war. So once you have made yourself good and the other side evil, when you do evil things, what does it make you? That's the question.
So I want to go back to this thing that I mentioned in the introduction, which is that before we sort of started acting on those conclusions that we were the good guys, the other guys were the bad guys, we did have the sympathy of much of the world. It's easy to forget that now because it didn't take very long before we felt like it was us against everybody.
It's remarkable, you know, Chris, to when we were making the film, I knew that I'd heard about this, that all over the world, everybody joined in. So we found all the stock footage we could find from television all over the world. And it is remarkable, some of the things we found that are in the film tonight. The front page of Le Monde, the French newspaper, "We are all Americans." You'll see Yasser Arafat in there, in the list of, or in the group of photos and video. It is remarkable. Tearful people in Germany, tearful people in Russia. The world united around us in a way that I had forgotten and hadn't actually understood the magnitude of it. It really is pretty amazing. If in the first scene of the movie, all of the members of the Congress, or many of the members of Congress in the Senate and the House, Republicans and Democrats, standing spontaneously, I gather, on the steps of the Capitol building, singing "God Bless America" a cappella together. The idea that that could happen now is inconceivable. And the same is true with this moment where all of the world joins in sympathy with America. We had more goodwill then than maybe any other time in the history of our nation, other than perhaps after World War II.
How did the CIA try to take down Osama bin Laden before the full-scale invasion of Afghanistan?
Well, they sort of promised that they they were the ones that could get there. They had the maps. They had this really intense leader of counterterrorism, Kofor Black. And he had attended meetings with George Tenet, the director, and Bush in the White House, in the Oval Office, the nights, in the evenings, right after it happened. And he had basically said, let us go in there. We're all ready to go. Forget the military. Forget a full-blown deal. In 2 weeks, we can be in there. We'll bring their heads back to you on pikes with flies on their eyes, he says. He in the film, he tells the head of the assault group for the CIA, go there, get bin Laden, cut his head off, put it on ice and bring it back. The bloodlust and the feeling that the gloves were off because of what had happened to America was just, it just was all over the Central Intelligence Agency, all over the White House, Oval Office. The president loved the idea that he could send in just a few troops and maybe there'd be some, there'd be air support and other things, but they'd go right in there and get bin Laden and bring him back, you know, dead or alive. That was the, and the CIA was promising that. Lots of money. They flew in with cargo planes full of cash, millions of dollars that the leader of the group was passing out in $100,000 increments to what was called the Northern Alliance, warlords and a combination of thugs that became our forces on our behalf, on horseback and other ways. While we bombed from the air, this group called the Taliban, they were moving across the landscape trying to find bin Laden, who, of course, had vanished.
So we did ultimately manage to significantly weaken the Taliban for a time, but we failed to capture bin Laden for a decade, and he was able to use his, like, repeated escapes as a way to really taunt U.S. leadership, right?
He had a, we talked to somebody in the film who said he had a policy, a philosophy, whatever you want to call it, a war plan, if that's not making it too grand, death by a thousand cuts to the United States. He gets to Pakistan and he starts to release these videos all over the world all the time, where he's giving essentially speeches toward America, like TED Talks from Osama bin Laden. And he's, you know, he's warning Americans. And somebody in the film says what he's really doing is he knows deep in his heart that America, which he has escaped from, and has gotten a great deal of street cred in parts of the world because he and his group Al-Qaeda have gotten away from the most powerful military in the history of the world. They got right out from under them and got to Pakistan, the safe havens where they could taunt us for years. And he was trying to do things that would cause us to make a mistake and go places. And it was almost like he had psyched us out and knew what was going to happen, things like torture and maybe even the invasion of Iraq. I think he knew America's impulses and maybe George Bush's inexperience would lead America to make the kind of mistakes we made.
So former President Bush has taken pains then and into the present to remind us all he was the decider. He was the guy in charge. It wasn't Vice President Cheney sort of running things from behind the scenes. But Cheney was there throughout the process. Tell us a little bit about his understanding of what had happened to the United States and what the 9/11 attacks might indicate about the future we were looking at.
Yeah, so somebody in the film tells us, Jane Mayer from The New Yorker tells us, Cheney was totally terrified. Something horrible had happened on his watch and the president's watch. It was something that he didn't ever want to have happen again. And he took the policy view or the practical view that if there was even a 1% chance that this could happen again, we had to be completely ready for it. So he was, of course, politically, philosophically, practically pushing for very tough stuff. He had made a speech on their presentation on Face the Nation on Sunday right after 9/11, where he said, the American people are going to have to understand, we're going to go to the dark side There's going to be, we're going to use methods and means that the American people don't know about. In other words, taking the opposite position of George Bush, who says we're the good guys, Cheney was saying, based, I think, on his fear and his expectation that, or his hope that this would never happen on his watch or the president's watch again. And in order to protect that, that meant we were going to have to cross the line with some of our some of our methods and means. He was so anxious, Jane Mayer tells us, about things that he kept a hazmat suit with a gas mask in a bag in the back seat of his car. That's how fearful he was of what was going to happen. And you know what? We can sort of smile about it now, but I think a tremendous number of Americans, as I recall, were also very fearful. It was really, in some ways, the very first time that kind of fear had entered the political bloodstream.
Michael, how did Bush's axis of evil come to sort of define the way he would approach these conflicts and this response to what had been an act of terrorism?
I think the biggest problem they had, Chris, was that they realized, as the sort of really the first time America had to deal with this, that Al-Qaeda was just a shadow. How do you fight shadows? As Condoleezza Rice, his chief of staff, said at the time, or no, she was NSA, National Security Advisor. She said, states fight states. They don't fight shadows. And you need to fight, you know, we need to find states that are harboring the terrorists. Well, that was, of course, the Taliban in Afghanistan, but where else? And so they decided, the neoconservatives, there were some neocons in the Defense Department and in the White House, who wanted some adventures anyway. They wanted to bring democracy to the Middle East and the world, so they'd and other places. So they decided to expand the war, and they created what they call the Axis of Evil, which really shocked many people in the world, especially our allies in Europe, France, Germany, and other places, because they expanded the definition of the war on terror to be states, Korea, Iran, and Iraq, Saddam Hussein in Iraq. And the idea was, in order to go forward to those states, you needed a cause, a reason, like a search warrant or something. And they decided that it was Saddam Hussein had a connection to Al-Qaeda, and Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction, and so did the other countries. And Bush said to America that night, his first State of the Union address, I'm not going to stand by while other nations come and do us harm. And in effect saying, it's not just about a handful of terrorists and some stolen airplanes. Yeah, this is about potentially about nuclear war or chemical war. And of course, everybody in America sat up and paid attention at the idea of that threat.
Colin Powell says in the film that he was a salesman at the United Nations hired to present a product, the product being the idea that Iraq had weapons of mass destruction and was prepared to use them. Did Powell believe what he was selling?
It's hard to know. I know an awful lot about it, that you could, as much as you can know about it by talking to the people who were actually in the room at the CIA when he was pushing back on the information they were giving him. He seemed to have real doubts at the CIA, seemed to have real doubts as he was preparing his stuff. There were people I've talked to in the from the UN who believe that he had doubts, and they believe they had heard him say that he had doubts. But that and it was bad enough that he made George Tenet, the director of the CIA, sit right over his shoulder in camera shot so that he would be tagged, if you will, with it. He wasn't going to give complete cover to Tenet and the CIA, but he did say it, and he did say things that were not true. And he did prepare the world. He was maybe one of the most trusted men in America, and he went forward, and that's why Bush chose him. And he went forward and he said things that were not true. Did he believe them? I don't know. I don't know. When we asked him about it, he said, look, I was a salesman. My job was to go sell this idea. Well, that's in some ways, that's a disappointing answer. If you believe that public servants, you know, exercise their judgment and their scrutiny and they don't say things they don't know. And I think when people always ask me, because our allegation in the film is that slowly but surely through all these events, people begin to lose trust in their government and trust in the truth that their government says. A lot of people say this is the first moment where people said, wait a minute, if we can't trust Colin Powell, especially after they discovered there were no weapons of mass destruction, then who can we trust? And that was the beginning of this division and polarization that begins to happen in America right around this time, where people just start to say, hold on a second. It's one thing to go after Al-Qaeda for hitting the buildings, but are we really after three other countries? Are we really after Iraq? Why are we going to Iraq? And that, a lot of protests in America and in Europe sprouted up then, more than sprouted up, you know, emerged, exploded onto the streets of Paris and other places, and San Francisco, Washington, lots of protests then, the beginnings of what would come to be a very divided America.
And of course, we were told that the war in Iraq would be over quickly without anticipating the sectarian violence that happened there. Why did Paul Bremer, as presidential envoy to Iraq, push so hard to expel tens of thousands of Ba'ath Party members from their jobs? Had he failed to understand the instability a move like that might create?
Well, he's an example of something that happened during this that people also begin to lose confidence in the government. The American military and the president of the United States had no idea what to do with Afghanistan, for example. We bombed the heck out of it, knocked the Taliban back. Osama bin Laden escaped, but we had the country. What are we going to do with Iraq, right? I mean, with Afghanistan. And the same is true with Iraq. We thought we'd go in, Don Rumsfeld, the Secretary of Defense, thought we'd roll in with the fast attack forces, 30, 40, 50,000 people, go in, take Iraq, and Iraqis would be so overjoyed, they would go back to work. The Ba'athists, who ran the government for Saddam Hussein, everybody would go back to work and the country would begin to operate again. This is a country that had been a dictatorship for a long time. No one had a plan that was ever put in action in either Afghanistan or Iraq after we took both of those places. And in Iraq, they finally decided that they had to have somebody. But who do they send? They send a diplomat who worked for Henry Kissinger's company, L. Paul Bremer III, who was not an Arabist, did not understand the Middle East, didn't speak the language. They sent him in there and they made him a sort of viceroy so he could run it. And the first two things he did are inexplicable, even to Colin Powell, who says it in our film. He got rid of everybody who's a Ba'athist, that is the religion, and they were Sunnis and they were the religion and whatever that was the minority in the country. The Shia are the majority. They got rid of all those people. Everybody who worked at every ministry, they were out of work. Then they got rid of the hundreds of thousands of soldiers just a few days later who had their guns and had their everything. The soldiers were prepared to fight for whoever the president was, and they took them away, thereby creating a circumstance in Iraq where there was no security at all. A building, there would be fires in downtown Baghdad that would burn for a month. There was no fire department. There was nobody to say, go put that fire on over there. The total looting we all witnessed on television, all that on top of not finding any weapons of mass destruction, I think put a huge dent in many Americans' confidence in the Bush administration, the president of the United States, the actions of the United States military, and certainly our allies also began to sort of step back and say, what's going on? And to be reminded of it now, 20 years later, when you see those scenes, for me, it was just astonishing that it had happened, and it had happened that way in the hands of somebody like Paul Bremer, who had no experience at all. It was horrible. It was a disaster, and it caused in the void, no security, no American military mandate to do anything. It caused those soldiers who'd all been unemployed to take those weapons that they had, and they knew where they were all hidden in the desert, take those weapons, and the insurgency begins right after that. The first car bombs begin to kill Americans on the highways almost right away after those decisions. And within months, there's a full-blown insurgency, and it doesn't take very long, year and a half, before there's a full-blown civil war between Shia and Sunni, and thousands of people are left dead. Every morning, they tell us, you would walk out onto the streets and find bodies laying up and down the street. It was just open warfare for years there. And it was because we didn't take control of the plane. We didn't know how. There weren't enough people there to do it anyway. And there was no plan. So once again, America failed over there. And the implications to the world were one thing. And the implications at home were starting to be something else.
Right, because meanwhile, you have reports that the detainees at Guantanamo Bay are being held without regard to the conventions of international law. Then you have these images from Abu Ghraib, and people weren't quite sure what to make of this, but there was a lot to argue over.
It was shocking to people we talked to. We talked to lots of Iraqis, of course, who just couldn't believe it. They said Abu Ghraib was the end, where they just believed America. Many people hoped America was going to save them from Saddam Hussein and hoped that Americans coming in would change the quality of their life. And they were thrilled at the very beginning. But by the time Abu Ghraib comes around and they see what American soldiers are doing to Iraqi men, many of whom, who knows, were they bad guys? Nobody knew. Nobody knew. They were just being grabbed and rounded up and put in this huge prison. I went to Abu Ghraib during that time, and it was massive. And it had been the big terror prison of Saddam Hussein. And now here's America opening it up and putting people in it. And the same was true with Guantanamo and the orange jumpsuits and the living in dog cages. And these are mostly men and boys from Afghanistan who were dragged and flown 24 hours blindfolded and put in there. And the world starts to say, and Americans start to say, especially when those pictures come out, this isn't America. Is this what we do? And in the midst of all that, by the way, the torture stuff started to come out and waterboarding. And people just, I think the people we talked to said that was just like utterly defining for the folly and what it was, the faith in America and government by Iraqis, by the people in Europe, our allies, the people in NATO, certainly our enemies, the Russians and the Chinese were very, they used it for everything they could get out of it. And this idea that George Bush had said about we're the moral ones, we're the Americans with our American values. It didn't look like American values what those soldiers were doing to people at Abu Ghraib and in Guantanamo.
All right, Michael, why did President Obama double down on the war in Afghanistan, even as he was planning to pull out of Iraq entirely?
I think he believed, and I guess I know this. Well, yeah, he believed that and had been told that it might be possible to win. There was much talk in the military about the surge that had happened in Iraq, and they thought that maybe it could work in Afghanistan. Now, he didn't want to give them the 80,000 people they said they needed, that is the military, but he did give them 30,000, and he did. But he also added an addendum, which is it all has to be done in 18 months. So General McChrystal, the military commander, went in, and they decided to do a demonstration battle in Helmand province in a place called Marja. They go in And they kind of prevail, but they don't prevail. It's like the crazy wars that happen there. And the Taliban is still fighting back. And the Taliban basically never gives up. And it's just always on them. McChrystal calls it a bleeding ulcer. And they can't win. And the word gets back to the White House. And Obama, who really thought he'd been assured that victory was something that could happen and really wanted to win, suddenly said, oh, my God, we're not going to win there. But, of course, he knew, he'd been advised by others, you can't pull out. Because if you pull out and another al-Qaeda grows up there or al-Qaeda moves back in and they attack America, that's it for your presidency. So we know you've got the, you know, you've got this hotbed over in Afghanistan. You're going to have to do what they, the term of art they use over there, which is mow the lawn. You're just going to take care of no terrorists. You're going to bomb them. You're going to use drone strikes. You're going to, anything that looks like terrorist activity, you're going to keep the lid on with these air power and drones. And he loves the idea. And he gets involved in it, you know, often many times a week, picking targets. And thousands of people die that way. A lot of civilians die that way. Children die that way. And America stays there and mows the lawn. That's what happened in Afghanistan.
Meanwhile, Obama does pull troops out of Iraq in 2011 and leaves behind exactly the sort of vacuum that you've described that ISIS swooped in to fill.
Yes, exactly. When I saw what was happening with Afghanistan a couple of weeks ago, I thought, well, this is what happened in Iraq, except it's the Taliban who are indigenous to the country. The fight from ISIS-K and others will come soon enough, I'm afraid. But what happened when Obama kept his campaign promise and sort of really did it? I mean, he really pulled everybody out of Iraq, including not just the military, 6,000 military personnel, but the State Department and other Americans who were there kind of running Iraq. And people came to him and said, you know, you can't do this. You can't go to zero. I mean, the ambassador came to him and said, please don't go to zero. You go to zero, this place is going to collapse. And though he did. And the number we received was 10,000 State Department and other officials, people were pulled out of Iraq at the same time. So now you've got a real vacuum there. And to fill that vacuum, civil war breaks out. The Shia, backed by Iran, start to take over. And up north, the Sunnis, the minority, the former Baathists and lots of the former army, who are in an insurgency anyway, are joined by al-Qaeda forces that come in. Bin Laden and others send in their forces, and ISIS is created. And ISIS then starts to devour land and is heading for Baghdad when Obama has to back up and go back in and send troops back in to stop the unbelievable carnage that ISIS is causing. Remember all those videos and beheadings and everything that came out of there as public relations tools by ISIS. It just eventually forces Obama's hand, and he's got to go back in. It makes one wonder whether we're going to see a part two of that in Afghanistan and what President Biden will do 6 months, 8 months, a year from now.
Well, that, of course, is my question. I mean, Biden was right beside President Obama when all this was happening in 2011. And it's worth pointing out that Iraq in 2011 is not exactly the same as Afghanistan in 2021. There are different forces at work. But, I mean, what can we take from the lessons of 2011 and apply to what is likely to happen over the next few months in Afghanistan?
Well, one of the things that's obvious is you don't know what you don't know, Rumsfeld's old saying. So who knows what's actually going on? We know that al-Qaeda and ISIS have metastasized across northern Africa, throughout the Middle East, Syria, Yemen, lots of other places. There are forces there, and And is Afghanistan now a welcoming, a more welcoming spot? Will the Taliban have its hands full just running the country and not be able to manage a struggle with ISIS and other groups? I don't know. I don't think anybody knows, but we have the experience. And you're right, Chris. They're not the same, but in some ways, the big things are the same. Ali Sifan, who's someone we trust and talk to, who was an FBI agent, who was in our film, and talks a lot about and knows a tremendous amount about Al-Qaeda, was one of the original FBI agents chasing Osama bin Laden before 9/11. And Ali wrote a piece in the Washington Post yesterday that essentially said, watch out, Afghanistan. Here we go again.
What is the current relationship between the Taliban and other extremist groups operating in the region, Al-Qaeda and ISIS and others?
I don't know enough about that to be able to say with complete certainty. But I would assume if they're trying to run the place, and these other people are coming in, it's very hard to know how they'll handle it. There is no love lost, as I understand it, but I don't really know. As I understand it, there's no love lost between ISIS-K and the Taliban. So, but is the Taliban ready and eager to wage a war against ISIS-K and anybody else that may join them? I don't know.
We passed the point a couple weeks ago, Michael, where more Americans have now died from COVID-19 than died in battle in the American Civil War. Do you have any sense, just as a journalist, as a guy who has been studying and documenting human behavior for decades now, why we are afraid in a different way of someone with a modified weapon killing us or someone we cared about than we are of disease?
I don't know that it's about the disease in some way. I mean, I don't know. Here's what happened in the 20 years of 9/11. A poison of fear was literally injected into the American political bloodstream. It really was. And I think it was, whether he knew he was doing it or not, Osama bin Laden was very capable in that one attack. And then the sort of anthrax things and the other, and all the news media going crazy and putting on television that, you know, there were dirty bombs and there was Osama bin Laden had a nuclear weapon. We put a lot of that in the film tonight so people would see it and say, oh, yes, I remember. There was so much fear in the country. And I think when people started to take sides, in some ways independent of political parties, because the Republicans were not who the Republicans are now in those days, it was all fear-based. And I think when you add to that race, when you add to that Black Lives Matter, when you add to that a president who's stoking the flames of that, using the language of the war, when that war in the Middle East came home, especially 2019, 2020, during President Trump's re-election campaign. And the sides were really taken. And they were out front and they were in the streets and local law enforcement was using weapons that were certain military surplus. We started to see on television every night that poison metastasizing inside the society to such an extent that when the Capitol building was attacked and assaulted, it was in effect something Al-Qaeda couldn't do that day. They tried to take the Capitol down in 2001. The Capitol of the United States of America was taken down by angry Americans, poisoned Americans. It's astonishing when you think about it. And they did what Al-Qaeda couldn't do. That happen for reasons that happened over the last 20 years. So that when you introduce a COVID or almost anything else, the climate change that people deny, America is on fire on one coast and underwater on another coast. It's just, I mean, I sit here after all these years of watching it and being in and out of Washington, and I grew up in Idaho, so I grew up in another place. And yet here we are.
I'm afraid, Michael, that we will have. I'm afraid that we will have to leave it there. We're out of time. The new documentary for the PBS series Frontline is called America After 9/11. Michael Kirk, thank you for spending this time with us.
My pleasure.
I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.